Currently, I'm an assistant professor at the University of Maryland. I guess I was at a postdoc at the same time as Amanda. And the turnover is such that we submit to APHA, and then we get new positions. So today I'm talking about, and actually this is more my research focus now, is the influence of economic factors in women's safe sex decisions. And I want to acknowledge my co-authors, especially Ralph DiClemente and Jonathan Zettelman, who really mentored this research. So it's not a surprise that relationship power dynamics influence whether people use condoms. If women have less power in their relationship, they're less able to have the leverage to insist on condom use. And there's emerging evidence that of birth control sabotage and coercive pregnancy. That when I spoke to Planned Parenthood of California, I asked them what was their top priority, and they said this was their top priority. They say so many cases of it, and they need to get a handle on how to deal with this. And we do have safe sex interventions that target relationship inequalities, but it's largely towards improving women's verbal skills, which can go pretty far, but there's structural inequalities in relationships that might influence their ability to be successful in these verbal negotiations. So these studies, and I'm presenting the research for two studies, look at whether economic factors influence safe sex, whether receiving money from a boyfriend and employment influence that. So unemployment, there's an extensive literature on youth employment, but usually it focuses on middle class populations. But there's a lot of research suggesting that in disadvantaged populations, employment can be really positive, and it can give women a sense of a future. Lori Zabin at Johns Hopkins told a story from the 60s when she was working at the very first federally funded birth control clinic. And this woman comes bounding in with a big smile on her face, and she says, "I need a birth control. I got my letter from the Jobs Corps today, and nothing's going to stop me now." And like, it wasn't until she had an incentive to prevent the pregnancy that she looked to do that. On the side of getting money from boyfriends, economic dependence on sexual partners is very common, but it hasn't been studied very much in the US. But there's a lot of research in Africa, and there's been a lot of interventions that have been quite successful in changing attitudes and showing people just how creepy it is for these much older men to be giving money to much younger women. And in Africa, it's not limited to low SES, and in the U.S. also, there's some differences as well. So, for example, there was a Something for Something campaign in Uganda, and there was just a very clear message that my mother taught me that my body's not for sale. There's a very successful campaign in Tanzania where they actually took the word fireworks and they called that this type of relationship, and that became actually a word that people would use. Like, we have sugar daddy. They had this word, fataki, and they would use it spontaneously. And there's also just some grassroots efforts as well. So the data I'm using is collected at Emory. It's 715 unmarried African-American women participating in a reproductive health or intervention. And I'm not looking at the intervention. They were ages 15 to 21, sexually active in the past 60 days, not pregnant, and not attempting to become pregnant. And they were interviewed at baseline 12 months and 6 months. Or 6 months and 12 months. And about a quarter of them, and this is how I got into this topic, a quarter of them said, when asked, what's your primary source of spending money? They said their boyfriend was. Not their parents, not their grandmother, not another relative, not a job, but their boyfriend. So the studies use two different methods, propensity score weighting and full matching. So now the sugar daddy's paper. So the propensity score model I use, I want to predict. So the way propensity scores work is you want to predict how likely people are to get money from their boyfriends, and then you match them up based on how similar they are, so that you're comparing apples to apples, not apples to oranges, right? Regression tries to take an orange and do arithmetic and multiplication and turn it into an apple. But propensity scores, you take similar things, like with like, and you compare them. So I predict getting money from a boyfriend, and I had 15 predictors that can be classified into three categories: boyfriend characteristics and relationship characteristics, economic background, and their other health risk factors. And with these 15 predictors, this is something that's also a good advantage of propensity score modeling, is that we can use that to create balance on 56 potential confounders. So we can identify 56 things where the groups might be different, and we don't have to stick them all in the regression model. We actually can control for them, basically, by weighting on propensity scores on a smaller set of variables. And that's really amazing how that works. And then I do 6 regressions for each outcome because we have 2 measures of condom use, and we have 3 waves, or 3 combinations of waves. And this lets us, we don't know very much about these sugar daddy relationships, I really wanted to get a sense of what was predicting it. But you don't want to be mining your data to find, you know, what the one significant effect. So what I did was I formulated the model in 1 of the 6 regressions, and then once I had picked the variables, that was it. I wasn't going to change the model, and then I applied it blindly to all the other regressions. So there was no chance that the other regression coefficients were significant because of this type of selection. So, on to the results. Women who get money from their boyfriends are, not unsurprisingly, different. They're less likely to be in school, they have lower educational expectations, they're more likely to have a history of abuse, both past and current, they have a bigger age gap with their boyfriend, and sex came earlier in the relationship. But after waiting, we actually get similar distributions for all of these variables, including the age, which means that the results that I find are not because this is an age-disparate relationship. They can't be attributed to the age disparity. They might be attributed to some unobserved variable that I haven't adjusted for, but it's not because of age disparity. So the only difference between the groups, between women who get money from their boyfriends and women who don't, that we've identified is the money. That's the only difference. And the results are really striking. That this is the odds ratio, the relative risk is also is very similar, but I'm plotting the odds ratio. And it's a consistent factor of 2 difference in never using condoms. So women who, so these are just all 6 regressions, the X scale is totally arbitrary. It's just the 3 different sets of regressions. But it's a consistent factor of 2 that women who get money from their boyfriends are twice as likely never to use condoms as women who don't. And these are all significant coefficients, which is really striking. It implies essentially that even if they don't think so, they're in sort of a transactional relationship and they're being bought, essentially. And going the other way, looking only at the women who get money, women who stop getting money are less likely to never use condoms. In other words, they're more likely to start using condoms. And this coefficient is significant in the point estimate, but they're not all statistically significant. So the point estimate is about the same, but they're not all statistically significant. So what I found, though, is that women who get jobs, one of the things that the main factors that predict stopping having the boyfriend be the primary source of spending money is getting a job. And women who get a job who have the same boyfriend and received boyfriend, so we're getting now to much smaller sets of people, women who get a job are 9 times as likely to discontinue receiving money, and the following wave of women who get a job are 7 times as likely to discontinue getting money from their boyfriend. So that comes to the next paper. But my conclusions for this paper is that women who get money from their boyfriends may not think they're having a transactional relationship. They might say that getting the spending money is just a little bit more than going out on a nice evening. But they are essentially engaged in a transactional relationship. And they may be implicitly trading safe sex and even their reproductive decisions for spending money. Because so few of these women are on oral contraceptives, the condoms are really their only line of defense. Condoms and withdrawal, but hardly anybody uses withdrawal. So condoms are their main line of defense against pregnancy, so essentially they're seeding not just what happens at that point, but also what happens to whether they get pregnant later on to their partner. Service learning pregnancy prevention programs and other programs that intervene with teenagers could start paying the teenagers because they, you know, they have them produce some useful service, but that could give them financial independence in addition to the self-efficacy that they aim at. So now on employment. The analysis for employment is that I model employment, so I see I estimate the probability that somebody is going to have a job using a human capital model, and then I use full matching and actually also nearest neighbor matching to create balance on the variables. So you start out with, this is a summary that these histograms show a summary of the propensity scores. So essentially, when these groups, the treated and the control, the treated are the people with jobs, the control are the people without jobs, and they start out looking different. And in this one variable summary of in their propensity score, which is just a summary of all the variables together. And when you match them up, they look similar, like the histograms really line up very well. Now, when we look variable by variable, with something called a love plot, named after Tom Love, who's at Case Western University, he's a statistician, not having anything to do with, it's very cool that that's his name and that he invented this. We start out, and I didn't label the variables here, but we start out that the employed women, the red are what they were like before matching, and the blue are what they were like after matching. So we see that there are some these red points that are outliers, that these are the variables where there's a big difference between condom users, I mean between employed women and non-employed women. The blue are what we get after matching. That after matching, all the variables pretty much line up, that they're not significantly different between the people with jobs and the people without jobs. So we've managed to balance the groups. And then this other method I used also created this balance. So I did the study twice using two different types of matching, but I got the same results, preliminary results anyway. This is, I haven't completely finished this. You want to get your matching done before you look at the results so that you don't bias your statistics, but when you apply for a grant, they want preliminary results, so you have to get a little bit, you have to get enough to at least tell the grant people what you have. So using full matching, I found women who are employed at baseline are less likely never to use condoms, more likely to use birth control, less likely to get money from boyfriends, and more likely to graduate high school. And this goes very well with the qualitative research that Kathy Newman, who's a sociologist now at Johns Hopkins, did, who found that once adolescents, disadvantaged adolescents are employed, they find that they have social networks that help them because they have peers who encourage them also to be industrious and work and go to school as well, that sometimes they have employers who encourage them to graduate from high school, that sometimes they, and who work around their school schedule, that and they also have an opportunity cost, that the cost of missing school for having a pregnancy may not seem to have a real opportunity cost. The cost of missing work, though, that shows up in your paycheck, and it's very clear that that there's a real opportunity cost. And just like the woman who came to Lori Zabin asking for birth control, the jobs can provide some type of sense of this opportunity cost. So the policy implications of both of these papers are that economic factors have a big impact in women's sexual decisions, and up until now they don't tend to address economic factors, but they should. That if they begin to address economic empowerment, that will allow them to be more effective. Of course, economic empowerment may be necessary, but not sufficient. Of course, there are a lot of other things that contribute to safe sex. But if you have a power disparate relationship, that may be undermining any intervention that you try to do. We have a lot of job training programs in many cities, but they focus on young men, the sense that we want to keep them off the streets, and there's a very good reason for that, given the high incarceration rate among men. But that's not the only, that shouldn't be the only concern. Young women can also benefit from these jobs programs, and certainly they do participate in them, but they're not focused on, they're not the main focus. And finally, conditional cash transfer programs, that there's a lot of them, and there's a lot of controversy about whether they give the right impacts and whether, you know, giving people money to read books or to get a certain number of A's on the report card is a really good incentive. But just giving money at all, these types of programs may help, and we haven't looked at that at all, and that could be something that we look at. And so thank you. If anybody, is there time for a question? Okay. And this is...
Oh, that's...
such a big question. That's a really big question. I think it goes deep into the roots of the feminist movement, into first and second and third wave feminism, and there's entire treatises on that, and I'm not qualified to address it. Yeah?
I've worked with teens in the past who purposefully engage in unprotected sex, not as a way necessarily to keep the money going, but because they wanted to get pregnant to secure the relationship. Did your data hint at that dynamic at all?
Well, this is interesting because in order to participate in the study, they had to say that they didn't want to get pregnant. So it's possible that some of, and 10% of them each wave did get pregnant, in fact. And so it's possible that they actually wanted to get pregnant, but they just also, but they also wanted the $50 per wave to participate in the study. I mean, it's really hard to say how much that was, but the study did not at all ask about pregnancy intention because that was the exclusion criteria.
Did you feel like there was any variation over type of employment?
There's a lot of variation in terms of part-time versus full-time, number of hours worked, and amount of money. But it was interesting because you could calculate how much money was necessary to get somebody off of their boyfriend's support. And it was about $200 a week on average, $150 in one wave and $200 in another wave. So it wasn't exactly a small amount of money, because especially if they're working, you know, $7 an hour jobs, but it also wasn't, you know, extravagant either. And you could cover that in 20 hours a week at $7 an hour.
I was thinking, actually related to this picture here, that a few years ago I was involved in a study in North Philadelphia where we were looking at teen pregnancy and trying to prevent the next pregnancy, the subsequent pregnancy, and we found in that analysis that having a job made them more likely to become pregnant again.
Really?
So we assumed in fact that the economic independence, I guess, you know, the pregnancy intention was greater than the opportunity lost, I think, to some extent. There's a slightly different group to yours. I haven't published it yet, but I'm just thinking I should go back and look at the relationship.
I would love to see your paper. I would love to see it. I was just about to ask the site, actually.
Any other questions?
I don't know if you were able to get that survey, but I was just curious about the teens' attitudes towards getting money from their boyfriend. If you got any sort of information on that, how they felt about it.
I wish we knew anything about it. It's just a question. It's not even a question, do you get money from your boyfriend? It's what's your primary source of money? And it's, you know, a list of seven options. So we can know, though, we can know what their attitude was towards the relationship and their attitude towards, like, whether they think they're going to get married to their boyfriend and whether they live with their boyfriend and whether they've broken up. And certainly, the money does seem to be a marker of commitment and feeling that the relationship's going to progress. That seems
So the girls told me that they're getting money from their boyfriends are still engaging in sex. They're just protected. So what are your thoughts on the cultural implications of using that terminology?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that there's a lot of possible words I could use. I use the word transactional because it does seem that there's a transaction being of sorts that money increases the economic value of the relationship to the woman. She's more, the opportunity cost of not acceding to her boyfriend's demands becomes higher. And if the boyfriend's asking not to use a condom, then she's more likely to comply with that. And there is this transaction. I mean, a lot of relationships, the economic factors do play into the relationship, even though there's certainly a huge context as well. I mean, there are feelings involved, for example, as Dr. Tana pointed out.
Was there a difference in between when the money exchange occurred? Like, did the money exchange occur before they had sex, or did the money exchange occur after they had sex?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, it seems that the question is spending money. So usually, and I don't know how it worked in these relationships, but often it will be as a regular basis rather than at the time of sex, right? That's clearly a very different thing. That's why these women may not consider it to be transactional. It's just the money gives their boyfriend higher weight in the relationship.
We're going to have to cut it off. If we have time at the end, we can come back to those questions.